Hare Krishna, everyone. And as Gopi Shoko mentioned, we're very fortunate to have Space Rancher Prabhu and also Space Vinayana Prabhu with us this morning. We're very blessed last year also they shared some static pastimes about their lordships. And we've all gathered today in honor of the 41st anniversary of Srimad Ramaneshwara. Just wanted to take this opportunity to mention also today, I think if Burley Baruch could hold up, there's a little offering being made to their lordships. It's in the form of a CD. This is the newest release. Last year we started on the mercy of Jagannath Sutapu, who's here. Radha Krishna Records label. And we released the 40th anniversary CD on that. And this is the second release on it. And this is a live album that was recorded on Nityananda Trinity, is it? Last year. So it's been mixed, and that will be available from today, I think, upstairs in the shop. And tomorrow we're going to have an official kind of launch party for it as part of the Sunday program and the 41st anniversary. Also, everyone could please turn off their mobile phones and mobile check. Thanks for the reminder. And also, we've received the master from the Troxy event, if any of you remember last year's Troxy event, so that DVD will also be showing parts of that today. So, like that. And Rancher Puru will be reading a little bit and sharing some pastimes from his book, When the Sun Shines. It was written about the history of Srila Prabhupada in the UK. Amazing book. Once you start to read, you definitely can't put it down. So much you'll be laughing and crying in the space of 5 to 10 minutes in some sections. Very, very wonderful book. So we'll have some copies of that also available here. And if you're quick, then you might be able to catch Rancho Peru before he goes and get a signed copy. So we'll have some of those available. We'd like to welcome both of these our esteemed guests now, if we can, by chanting very loudly 3 Hari Bols.
Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol!
Grace Rancho Peru ki.
Jai!
Ananda Peru ki.
Jai!
Someone's bringing their coffee, huh?
Yeah. this morning, when I was contemplating being here to talk about this book, I just, you know, opened it, as you can with any book, you can just open it and see where the Spirit leads you. And it fell open on a paragraph that began with the name Robert Houston, who happens to be sitting next to me. Because that is the name that you were born with, right? Robert Houston. In the course of writing this book, I personally interviewed about 50 godbrothers and godsisters, and I collected about another 30 interviews through indirect means. And I did my best to weave into the story of Prabhupada the story of the many souls who gathered around him. And I made a decision early on to begin their stories, their personal stories, where they were prior to meeting Prabhupada, and to give them their birth names, because that's part of who each and every one of us is, you know. We're born into this world, we choose our parents. We gain our identity in this earthly realm from the parents we choose, the family we choose, who give us names. And that is part of who we are while we're here in this world. So I began with, in this case, Robert Houston. And then, when the appropriate time came, I gave their spiritual name, Rahini Nanda, which is also another part of, you know, our identity in this world, for most of us here, to be Hare Krishna devotees, members of International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and servants of Prabhupada. Somebody asked me, last week I was in Brighton, and one of the community there has said, you know, we really enjoyed reading your book, but just one thing. And I thought, oh, this is good, because I always like to hear anything I can do to improve, you know. Is, you know, I followed the stories of all these individuals, but then suddenly, you know, they vanished from the story. What happened to them? Because my book only takes us up from 1969, oh well, 67 it begins, to 77, when Prabhupada left this world. What happened to them? So I said, well, in fact, I did have a plan at one stage to include an appendix with a picture of just a little sort of passport-sized photo of each of the characters, roughly 80 characters in the book, if possible, as they were then, and also as they are now, and a short summary of what happened to them since 1977. You know, we're here to celebrate the 41st anniversary. That means we're 41 years on from when these events unfolded. We are here today, and we are where we are. And dwelling on the past will not serve us. Knowing about the past, understanding the past, will serve us. So it's a long road, actually. Life and the moment of initiation. In the case of this temple, the moment of initiation was 41 years ago, 1969, is the start of a journey. And it's a journey that Prabhupada started the temple, but he started actually through his agents, his disciples. It was a joint effort. And he, in the short time that Prabhupada was with us, you know, circling the world constantly for those 10 years, 12 years that he was preaching outside India, he never stayed anywhere for very long. The longest he stayed in England was a couple of months on one occasion when we got the manor. Otherwise it was maybe a month or even sometimes just a few days. Altogether it totals about 9 months the Prabhupada spent in England over those 10 years. But in general, most parts of the world, he was here today, gone tomorrow. And most of Prabhupada's disciples never met him. I mean, they might have seen him from a distance. They never exchanged a word with him. And then he was gone. It seemed a long time then, you know. But in retrospect, it was a brief interlude, really, that Prabhupada was here. And, you know, he started something and then basically handed it over to his disciples and his succeeding generations of followers. And ISKCON is what we make him. Actually, it doesn't belong to Prabhupada. Do you think he ever thought that? Just the thought of it is laughable, isn't it? He never claimed possession of ISKCON. ISKCON belongs to all of us while we're here, and it will belong to our children and our grandchildren. So it's what we make it. And if there's anything about ISKCON, you know, that you don't like, there might be, then you can change it. That's what Prabhupada wanted from his disciples. He wanted us to learn to be Krishna conscious, which means to have that connection with Krishna, and to really to have faith in that, not to need to be told, but to find our own connection with Krishna. So I just say that because it is a journey, and that question set me thinking, you know, where are they now? I don't know exactly how many, the 5,000 odd disciples of Prabhupada initiated. In this country it was 300. I managed to get to speak to roughly 50 of them. About half of them I wouldn't know how to find. And of those who I knew how to find, not all of them were willing to be interviewed, for whatever reason. You know, there's a whole story that I could write another book, I could. Which, what happened next? How did each one of us find some direction, or fail to find some direction in our lives after meeting Prabhupada? So I'm going to begin, and we'll see where this goes. I'm going to begin with reading just a little excerpt from the prologue. When I was writing this book, I had to decide, you know, to what extent can I put myself in the book, part of the story. It's quite tricky to, you know, I couldn't really write a book about everything that happened and then just write it through my own eyes. That wouldn't be... I chose not to do that anyway, because I wanted to write the group story. So I didn't use the first person I... but I did choose to put a little prologue on the front of the book where I used I. And I recalled, you know, the last time I saw Prabhupada, which was his Vyasa Puja Day in, at Bhaktivedanta Manor in 1977. The previous day, Janmashtami, Prabhupada came here. Well, he came to Berry Price to see Radhananda and Shwaran, to basically to say goodbye to them. And I was there then. And he said goodbye also to me, because I happened to be the president at the time. You know, a very special occasion. It's the first time Prabhupada visited Radhananda and Shwara. That year, he did come and see them one day the previous year. After we got the manor, Prabhupada never stayed in London. So when he came, each time he came to the manor, he came on a day excursion to see Radha and Shwara Balsam. And so it was a special occasion that Prabhupada came to see Radhananda and Shwara, and then as now, Radhananda and Shwara had their particular servants, you know, people who felt identified with this temple and didn't really go to the manor that much. Some of them never had time to go to the manor. So I was the president, and I thought, well, somebody's got to offer arti, because Prabhupada's come. We decided, you know, Prabhupada's coming to have darshan, regardless what time of day it was. You know, we'll open the curtains, we'll have deity greeting, we'll have arti. And as I recall, it was in the afternoon, but that seemed fine. You know, Krishna would want to wake up to see Prabhupada. So somebody, you know, has to be behind the curtain and be doing all of that. So I thought, well, I'll do that. And then everyone else can, you know, they can go outside and greet Prabhupada and bring him in and so on. And we had an arrangement whereby there was we'd made a platform in the middle of the temple where Prabhupada could be carried in on a palanquin, on a chair with handles. And he could be placed on that, and then there would be a kirtan. So I heard the signal that Prabhupada had arrived, and so I started the arti. And, you know, once, if you're the pujari, you're not looking at the temple, you're looking at Krishna. And I began offering the arti, and when I turned around with the incense, in arti, you know, when you offer the different articles, at a certain point you offer to the spiritual master, which at that time, I don't know how they do it now, but at that time that came last. That was the system we had then. Begin with Krishna, and you work your way down. So when it was time to offer to, normally, you know, to the picture of Prabhupada, of course, well, Prabhupada's actually here, so I can offer to him. So I turn around, expecting to see him halfway back down the temple, but he had been brought right up to the step. So he was just touching distance. And I offered the incense to him. And he looked in my eyes, and his eyes were full of tears, which they were anyway all the time then. And he nodded to me, and in his heart and my heart, I guess, he said goodbye. So was, it really, that was my farewell to Prabhupada in this earthly realm. But I did go to the manor the next day, which was Vyasa Puja, and Prabhupada was up on the platform, 100 or so people there. And Tamal Krishna, Prabhupada wasn't speaking in that last visit, he wasn't well enough to speak publicly. So Tamal Krishna told Goswami, told his story. He sort of recited the biography of Prabhupada essentially for an hour or so. And I began my book here with the prologue, sort of remembering that occasion. And while Prabhupada was speaking, I wrote here, while Tamal spoke, my mind travelled back to the first time I had seen Prabhupada. It seemed a lifetime ago, but it had only been 6 years. His disciple Shamsundar had befriended me the day I walked into the London temple. He a carpenter and sculptor, me an architect and artist. He with his easy West Coast drawl, me with my modest English diction. A few weeks later, after I'd moved into the temple, Shamsundar went to India with his friends. A year elapsed before he returned, this time with Prabhupada. Then he brought me into his Divine Grace's room, sat me down before him, and generously introduced me. This is Renshaw, Prabhupada. He will be working on the plans for your Mayapur temple. Prabhupada had wanted to know about me. I did my best to answer his questions, but in his majestic company, I felt clumsy. Over the ensuing weeks, Shamsundar, with his relaxed and friendly ways, helped me to feel more at ease and accepted in Prabhupada's presence. Well, that's just a snapshot of that first year when I met Prabhupada, which was 72. You know, like many of us, for me, the temple was something of a port in a storm. I was an art student at Chelsea, experiencing, as we do, life in this world, in the raw, with its ups and downs, and all its intensity, when you're 19. Actually, it doesn't get any less intense, I don't think, but perhaps after a while, living in this world, you know, we do maybe, sometimes we might get sort of numb, I suppose, to the pain mostly of living in this world. So I was 19 and I was raw, and I had a succession of intense experiences, and by the time I was just past my by the time I reached my 20th birthday, I had sort of come to the conclusion that I didn't belong in this world, and that I couldn't really see a future. I wanted to be an artist, I was an artist. But I didn't feel, I suppose, an inspiration. And then that was the time when, you know, I met, I had a powerful sense of a connection with God. That was the only thing that really was important in my life. And that was the time that I met the devotees. I found the temple. And immediately I just felt, this is a place that I can identify with. So I think this happens to many people, who for one reason or another, they've kind of woken up to the fact that, you know, happiness in this world is a very difficult thing to find. And even if you think you've found it, pretty soon it gets snatched away. and the pleasure turns to pain. And so you come to the temple, as Krishna says, you know, the distressed, take shelter of me. Those in search of relief. And the temple offers that. It offers a place of shelter. And also a balm for the soul, a sense of connection to Krishna, a sense of a shared spiritual experience. You know, here are some other people who also feel that they are spirits in the material world. And so that was, you know, Prabhupada was asked once, that what do you think is your greatest achievement? And he kind of unhesitatingly said, I've given a home to so many boys and girls who were loitering here and there. I've given them a home. And so I'm so grateful to Prabhupada that he provided a place for that, you know, lost and confused young man to come in to. And, you know, I threw myself into, as many of you have done, into the service of the mission. Heart and soul. Of course, that's not the end of the story, is it? I remember when I was being I moved into the temple. I went round, before moving in, I managed to borrow the temple van. We still had a van then, it later got possessed, repossessed from me. So I got loaned with the temple van to go around to the art college and collect all my works of art, which were mostly quite large canvases. In the sort of Rothko, is it Mark Rothko, something like that? Yeah, Fergus? Yeah. Fergus, my nephew, by the way. He's also an artist. It's very nice to see him here. So I had these large canvases and I thought, well, I don't know, any, these are not really going to be any use to anyone now, because I'm giving all this up. Of course, a condition to move into the temple was that I could continue to paint, but it wasn't going to be Mark Rothko's. You know, Rothko paints these huge abstract paintings that are very much sought after now. So I borrowed the temple van and I drove around to my mother's place in Nell's Court and I said, Mum, I'm moving into the Hare Krishna temple, I just came to sit by. And I got these paintings, you know, if you want any of them, and a few other bits and pieces. So I think she was a little, well, she was obviously shocked. But she took the paintings in. And I went over and moved into the temple. And the next morning I got a phone call from my father. And he's at the temple. Somehow he managed to track the phone number down of the temple, which means he must have been doing, quite keen to get in touch with me. Pardon me?
Quite a few parents did that.
Yeah. And he asked me, he said, what's this on here, old chap? You've moved into the Krishna temple? I said, well, yeah, I found my home. And he said, well, he said, do me a favour, can you, please? I've arranged with the monks, that's the monks at Worth, which is the Worth Abbey in Sussex, where I went to school, that you can go and stay there. They've arranged a room for you. Stay with them for a couple of weeks and just think about it, would you? I said, sure, that sounds like a great thing to do. And so I did. I did exactly that. I'd stayed in the temple one night, but I took a train or whatever down to Worth, which is near Crawley, Worth Abbey. Fantastic place. And I stayed there. In fact, in the end, I only stayed for 1 week, I think. And while I was there, I thought about it. I chanted a lot. I wandered in the beautiful estate, you know, which covers hundreds and hundreds of acres of rolling Sussex countryside, with my beads, chanting, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. I got so absorbed, especially Hare Rama, Hare Rama. And I was in ecstasy, chanting lots of rounds. And then one by one, just about every monk in the community kind of cornered me. And we had long talks. And they all went away sort of, I guess, lost for anything else to say. Because I could not be deterred. And I also managed to somehow make my way into most of the school, boarding school, into most of the classrooms, and give talks about Krishna. I knew nothing about Krishna, but I was invited in. And at the end of a week, I decided I'd thought about it long and hard, and then, you know, I was definitely going to move into the temple. It was just a question of how long do I have to stay here before I go back. There doesn't seem to be a lot of point in spending another week. And so I told the monks, you know, I'm leaving tomorrow morning. And the abbot, Victor Farwell, he called to see me. He said, can you ask Richard to come and see me? So I went to the abbot's cell, and he said to me that the monks, you know, are very concerned about my eternal soul, and they have come, some of them have come to see him, and said, you know, we would like to have a vigil to pray for Richard's soul, which means staying up all night. For me, which I think is pretty amazing, actually. I mean, I think that's wonderful that they should have had that sometime. But the abbot said, but I told them, don't worry, he's fine. He's doing what he has to do. Just let him do it, and he's in, you know, he's something like, you know, God will look after him. So I really appreciate. And he said to me, later he denied this, but he did say it to me at the time. He said, you know, if I were your age, I'd do the same. So with the blessings of the man who later became head of all the Benedictines in Europe, I moved into the temple and took up my paintbrush every afternoon. To paint pictures of Krishna for 3 days, and on the fourth day, because I was given that undertaking, yes, you can spend half your time painting pictures, and on the fourth day something came up, and so it was, you know, I didn't paint pictures of Krishna, which is a great shame. I mean, anyone who has a talent, be it painting or any talent, any ability, capacity that you have, must use it. Krishna. Krishna says that very clearly in the Bhagavad Gita. Twice. Don't try to do another's occupation, even if you can do it well. Do your own. And he repeats that. There's only two verses in the Gita that Krishna repeats. One is always think of me. And the other is, do your occupation. I mean, it's the thing that inspires you, yeah? The thing that you feel, this is what I'm meant to do. Anyway, eventually I did get to paint. That was a few years later. I spent a year painting in Los Angeles for Prabhupada's books, which I'm very grateful for. But I moved into the temple, and after that first 3 days of being a devotee artist, I became just a devotee, what do they say, you know, whatever's required. And mostly it was preaching. And that's how, you know, the London Temple, say Prabhupada was not here much. At one time when he did, when he came on one of those brief visits in the afternoon, I think it was in 73 or 70, possibly 74, and he came and sat in front of Radha Krishna, and he said that now the movement is expanding. We have so many temples. I can't be in one place for more than 15 minutes. He said, so I'm leaving Krishna in your hands, and I'm praying to Krishna to give you the intelligence how to look after him. And so, you know, we used whatever intelligence we could muster, and we preached like anything, didn't we, really, in the 70s? All over the country. I don't think anyone got 6 hours. I don't know if anyone does now, but I don't think they did then. Sleep, I mean. We caught up in Bogota class. just work. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There was no holidays, no weekends. People didn't go to India. Just work. And I'm not recommending that. But it was emergency, it was all hands on deck, and you know, the movement spread slowly at first, but it picked up speed, and by the end of the 80s, it's incredible actually. By the end of the 80s we had Chaitanya College, which was this vast estate in the Midlands. I can't remember what the size of the estate was, can you really? Hundreds of acres. With the most fantastic facility imaginable. Well, of course, we expanded too fast, I suppose, because it all came kind of crashing down, really, in the 80s. But that's another story, because it's an amazing, it's absolutely amazing that the temples have steadily, you know, there is advance and retreat, and advance and retreat, and advance and retreat, but each time the advance is a bit more secure, and the generations are growing. And the movement is really strong now, which is wonderful. And as I say, we have many generations. We have those who like ourselves when we were young, who are able to dedicate their full time to Krishna's service. Actually, I have to rephrase that. Anyone can, you know, we can all devote our full time to Krishna's service, but not necessarily in the mission, because Krishna's teaching is very clear on this. That, you know, if I can live my life in this, with the awareness that I am, after all, a servant of God, and that really that is the purpose and the aim of my life, then my life becomes an offering to God. And I am, you know, I once asked Prabhupada, how do you choose what to do in the service of Krishna? And he gave a very surprising answer. He said, you don't have a choice. You just do what Krishna gives you. So Krishna may give you something quite unexpected. you know, he might give you a challenge so great you don't know if you can survive it. Or he might suddenly just like open up a whole field of activity that you had never expected. Or he might even fulfill your desires. I mean, ultimately, the desires of the soul are what Krishna fulfills. But not always straight away. We have now, you know, many generations, and some of us are working here in the temple. Nowadays, of course, most people are not. They're working in, out in the world, applying to the best, each of us, to the best of our ability, how to find Krishna in the most unexpected places, and how Krishna will lead us into the most unexpected places. And it's all part of the Leela. Because once I say to Krishna, that Krishna, I'm yours. You know, that's a deep expression of intent in life. Krishna, I am yours. And that is a moment that has come, I think, probably to most people. If not now, it will. If you come around and spend time with the devotees and visit to Krishna here. Krishna, I'm yours, you know. Then, from that time on, we're on a journey with Krishna. So that summer that Prabhupada came, when I was introduced to Prabhupada by Shyamasundara, yeah, something pretty unexpected happened to me. I had been, you know, working in the temple for roughly a year, driving, you know, to the market and picking up the vegetables, or going out and hurrying out on Oxford Street, or cooking, or preaching, distributing Back to Godhead magazines with the Harinam Party. That's the way we did it then. Just the Harinam Party went down Oxford Street every morning, accompanied by, well, you know, we took it in turns that some would be singing and some would be passing out Back to Godhead magazines. And that was how the, you know, the movement was funded for the first 5 years, at least 5 years, just by Back to Godhead magazine selling on the street. And Back to Godhead magazine always had one article by Prabhupada, and all the other articles were written by his disciples. What little we knew, Prabhupada encouraged us to write, you know, and to publish our writing in the magazine. So that's how we spread the Krishna consciousness movement in the early years. Prabhupada had a lot of faith in passing the torch to his disciples. And the books came later on because the Bhagavatam, you know, was as it was, as Prabhupada proceeded through the Bhagavatam, as each volume was printed, it got funded by being sold, and that paid for the next volume and so on. And so it was all part of Prabhupada's plan how to publish 50 volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam. They had to be sold, but the essential business was selling the Back to Godhead magazine. And we had that little blue Bhagavad Gita that some of you might have seen that was published by Macmillan, little short little 250 page abridged version of Prabhupada's Gita without any Sanskrit, and that's the first Gita that, you know, I got. And we had Krishna book. I know that you had that. And so our method was, you know, we chanted on the street, and I know that that goes on every day. Yeah. And we did actually take a lot of care to chant in an attractive way, you know, that people would like So we were doing that, and in the mornings and the afternoons we went to other parts of London. We went to King's Road, which is where I saw the Diversities first because I was an art student there. We went to Kensington High Street, we went to Hampstead, we went to Victoria, and we went on Saturdays, we went further afield. You know, we might go to one of the surrounding towns, a place like Guildford or wherever, or else we might go to Portobello Market, which again, I saw the Diversities in Portobello Market. I think that's the first time I saw them. Portobello Market. Now, I think Camden Town is the trendy place, but it was Portobello then. And I had a stall there with a friend selling, you know, beads and incense, as one did. And one day I sort of felt, rather than heard, this presence coming through the crowd. And I saw incense billowing, and I heard bells, and suddenly emerged through the crowd this group of people praising the Lord. I didn't know who they were, what they were doing, but it was something very, very different. And I bought a magazine. Back to the magazine, couldn't understand a word of it, but it had a certain feel about him. So we were spending a lot of time doing the Hurry Now, and I was doing that for a year. And then Prabhupada came in the summer of 71, and I had already been initiated by letter. And he was not well for the first few days, he was confined to his room. But he had news from Mayapur that some land had been donated, finally. Some, or not donated, I think purchased eventually after a lot of legal wranglings. His disciples in Bengal, which included Tamar Krishna and I think Jayapataka, they had managed to negotiate the purchase of a strip of land. And the news had just come. And immediately Prabhupada wanted to have plans drawn up for a magnificent, huge temple, which was pretty inconceivable at the time. And so somehow Shamsunda, who travelled with Prabhupada as his secretary, got to know that I had an architectural training, and so he introduced me to very confused, you know, why is he interested in me? Well, why not? Why wouldn't Prabhupada be interested in any one of us? Why wouldn't any of us be interested in each other? You know, we're all eternal spirit souls. And glorious children of God. So why wouldn't Prabhupada be interested in me? But I had this complex, I suppose. Why is he interested in me? And Prabhupada wants to know where I was born and where I was educated, those sort of things. And then he began to talk about his plans for Mayapur, and for the next couple of weeks that was my full-time service, was reporting daily to Prabhupada and doing drawings of the plans, and as they, you know, as each day some progress was made, showing him the plans and getting his comments back, and spending a lot of time in his room. Not just me, there were two or three of us. And to some extent, those plans actually, they survived And the original plan was for this huge temple and four residential blocks that were to be ashram buildings. And the first of those ashram buildings was built exactly as we planned it, and that's what became the original Mayapur temple, and still stands to this day. And then, of course, the big temple is sort of finally underway now, pretty much where it was originally planned to be, as it happens. So that was wonderful, because it also meant I was called to go on Prabhupada's daily walk in case, while he's walking in Russell Square. Prabhupada always went for a walk every morning, and he liked to walk briskly, and he would do a few circuits of Russell Square usually, or else he might be taken further afield. Sometimes I got the chance to drive him to Hyde Park or to Regent's Park or Kensington Gardens, different places. And on his morning walk sometimes, he might just, the conversation might turn to Mayapur. Well, it did most mornings in those next couple of weeks. And he talked about his plans, and so I had to be there, you see. That was my duty, to be there and hear what he had to say. So after a couple of weeks, I started to kind of get used to being in Prabhupada's presence, because it's quite a overwhelming experience to be in the presence of someone who is so self-possessed, you know, who's so totally in the present moment. So that if Prabhupada, you know, would turn his gaze towards me, it would be total attention, and then it would turn away again, a bit like a sort of a searchlight, you know. If it would come on to me, I would just be caught in the headlights, you know. And that happened to many of the Prabhupada's disciples, because he was completely present. And so whatever he said carried his full truth. Whatever movement he made, you know, any gesture, carried his full presence. If Prabhupada was eating, which mostly he did on his own, but occasionally, you know, I saw him eating, he was completely absorbed in the food. Yeah. And if, of course, he was chanting, he closed his eyes mostly and just absorbed himself in the chanting. So, you know, that is self-realization. To be fully, totally present. So quite mesmerizing to be in the presence of someone like that, but also quite exposing. And this is an experience that many people spoke to me about, you know, that when they're with Prabhupada, they felt exposed. Because it's you know, you're in the presence of a sort of naked spiritual energy. At the full form. But anyhow, I did learn to begin to feel a little less nervous in Prabhupada's presence that first summer. And after a couple of weeks of that, I can't remember, maybe 3 weeks, that job was done. The drawings were complete. And it was soon time for Prabhupada to leave. And his next port of call was going to be Nairobi. So he was on his way to India, but he was going to go via Nairobi, in fact, Mombasa, because his health was not good. His private health mostly was not good towards the end of his life. But he just overcame it. So he'd been offered a place to stay on the sea, on the coast in Mombasa, which he accepted that offer. It might be a good place to recuperate and rest for a few days. But he was on his way to India, and he was taking with him some of his, mainly his American disciples, to get on with the construction of the new temple. That was the plan. So they went ahead to Mombasa, or to Nairobi, to prepare for a program for Prabhupada. And there was this, and everyone, you know, while Prabhupada was staying here in London, devotees from all over Europe came and sort of crashed on the stairs. Do you have that phrase still? Crashed? Can you crash at a friend's place? Yeah. So the whole building at night was just full of sleeping bodies in every available space. But in those last few days, everyone went back to their separate temples, and it was just a few of us, you know, we were less than 20, as I recall. And Prabhupada, and the, you know, his important sort of important devotees from America had, they'd gone. And so there was a just a little window of a few days, and Prabhupada got a letter from his disciple Vaikunthanath, who's married to Saradia, who's now my sister-in-law. And they were in Trinidad, and they had been offered a donation of land. And Prabhupada, again, he wanted a drawing for a temple. So he called me, and this time it wasn't, you know, Shamsundar passing on the message, it was a direct message, Prabhupada wants it. So I went in to see him, and he said, you know, I want you to make a drawing for some drawings for another temple. And so then that was just me and Prabhupada for, so I think it was 3 days. And that was actually wonderful that he, you know, he gave me his instructions, how he wanted it done. And it was a little, just a little exchange, 3 days, which was probably my most, one of my treasured memories, to spend that time with Prabhupada. And then he was gone. But during that stay in the summer of 72, 71, I mean, he, there were some memorable occasions, including, I think including the talk at Hampstead Town Hall, was it? Was that 71?
Yeah.
It might be 72. Okay. Yeah, there was just one. Well, there was one. The Prabhupada gave several public talks, and we had no money, but we needed to publicize the talks. So somebody offered to pay to put 200 posters up on the underground in the stations, you know. And it didn't occur to us, somehow it didn't occur to us. We didn't have, I guess getting things printed was a bit more complicated then. Now you just put it on the computer and whiz it out on your printer. But it was a bit more complicated then to produce a poster. So we wanted to make a lovely, colourful poster. And so somebody had the idea of, well, let's make silkscreen, you know, posters. So silkscreen is where, you know, you have like a fine mesh spread on a, stretched on a frame. And you kind of wax it up so that the ink will only go through the holes that are not waxed. Right? So we set up a silkscreen press in the upstairs in the temple, in the fourth floor. And we managed to get some paper donated. We managed to get silkscreen printing ink donated. And I made this design. And it was a picture of Prabhupada taken from the Rathiatra in San Francisco, where he's standing like this with his arms outstretched with a big ecstatic smile on his face. So I turned that into a silkscreen design and wrote over the top, pure love of God, with rays like sunshine, you know, shining out of Prabhupada. And then underneath it said, the different venues for the, it might have been the following year, it was 71. We had a couple of venues, and these posters duly appeared on the London Underground in bright pink and blue and yellow. Very 71 inch ones, that period, you know, of art, kind of pop art style. And so we were making, we were doing the silk screening upstairs, and we knew we needed a couple hundred posters. We had the paper donated, and so there was the paper piled up, and it was three colours. So, you know, the first colour goes down, you pour the ink into the frame, and then with a big squeegee, you move your squeegee across and squeeze the ink down through onto the paper. And then you put it aside to dry. It needs a few minutes for the ink to dry before you do the next colour. So we started, you know, and pretty soon, of course, the room was full of drying bits of paper. And so then the drying bits of paper started to migrate down the stairs, out into the street, down to the end of Bury Place, and then back down the pavement on the other side. So the whole of Bury Place, which is, you know, a street 100 yards long, was filled with drying posters. And of course it was summer, the weather was fine, but it was evening. And you know, as the one colour was finished, then the dry bits of paper were being brought up. We had a whole assembly line going on to put the next colour, and as it was coming evening, the little breeze picked up, you know, and so it was a sort of damage limitation exercise, because the undried, the sheets of paper with ink still wet were rolling down the street in the breeze. But somehow we managed to convert the whole of Bury Place into a silkscreen production assembly line, and we produced our 200 posters, and we got them up online in the underground. For me, I mean, that just it took everyone. After, you know, we didn't plan it properly because we were young and impetuous. So we had a team of probably three, but by the time we finished it, we had a team of 23. You know, running back and forth. And it sort of, to me, it just stands in my mind as a wonderful metaphor, actually, for the Krishna consciousness sort of journey, that, you know, you great enthusiasm, you start, and you don't really know how you're going to finish, but Krishna inspires you, and somehow, you know, you get there in the end, and lots of people get involved, and, you know, the spirit inspires in so many ways. It inspires us to do wonderful things, you know. I really like the way the temple's been decorated today with these pictures over the paintings. I don't know, is that something you normally do, or is this somebody just thought, oh, that would be nice? Anyway, whatever, at some point somebody must have thought that would be nice. It is. That's lovely. To use imagination and vision and creativity in the service of Krishna, whatever way it comes. It's wonderful. So we had these posters, and one of those, that summer, one of the programs was at St. Pancras Town Hall, which is up near St. Pancras Station. Still there, same place, hasn't changed. And I have a wonderful memory of, you know, we strolling up there in the evening, in the warm summer evening, strolling up with our mridanga, probably had a couple of mridangas, and our kartals, and somebody somehow getting Prabhupada's Vyasa-san there, and then Prabhupada arriving, and he gave a talk mostly about the four modes of material nature. I think, Prabhupada, why are you talking about the four modes of material nature? Sorry, three modes of material nature, to an audience of complete newcomers, but Prabhupada just spoke whatever was there. You know, he spoke his truth. And of course, actually, you can analyze any, which I did a lot of when I wrote my book, any of the talks that Prabhupada gave when we have the recording survives. And they are beautifully constructed. He never just spoke for very long. I mean, I've spoken now for over an hour. I'm going to stop in a minute. But Prabhupada never spoke for more than 20, 25 minutes. And in which he just sort of gave a little sort of capsule of wisdom, self-contained wisdom. So on that occasion, although he was speaking about three modes of material nature, he did include something about you're not this body. And I just remember at the end of that talk, the question, somebody stood up in the audience to ask a question or shouted a question. A question. I mean, any speaker likes questions. So the question was, why are you wearing so many rings? You're meant to be, you know, a renounced person. And Prabhupada just turned away, you know. He refused to answer the question, but he said to Shamsunda, you know, he just nodded to Shamsunda. He did that sometimes. So Shamsunda explained that, I can't remember the full details, but the rings were gifts. One of the rings, Prabhupada wore, I think, three rings. Probably changed at different times, but one of the rings he was wearing at the time was a gift from Janaki. Janaki was Prabhupada's first female disciple, and she wanted to give him the most valuable thing she had, which turned out to be her wedding ring. Or I don't know if it was her wedding ring, but it was a precious ring that she wore. And somehow, it had lost the stone, but it was still a nice ring, but the stone was missing. But she thought it was special. So she gave it to Prabhupada. This was back in, I guess it was 68 or something, she gave him the ring. And Prabhupada wore it. As far as I know, he wore it for the rest of his life. So Shamsunda mentioned something about that. Actually, you know, it was an interesting question, because what it revealed was how much Prabhupada really did care about his disciples. You know, there was me thinking, oh, why would he be interested in me? Of course he's interested in anyone who places their faith in Prabhupada. That is another time. I think this was Janaki, actually. She didn't tell me, but I got the story through Yamuna, her sister. She said to Prabhupada, "Oh, Prabhupada, I feel, you know, when I come into your room, I'm just wasting your time. You've got so much work to do." Prabhupada said, "You are my work." Yeah. Well, I'll close that to just contemplate the fact that, you know, we we all care. We all and we all have the capacity to really care about everyone in our lives, you know, to really love other people. Actually, in proportion to how much we care about ourselves. And as Prabhupada was somebody who was completely present, and that means caring about yourself, and that includes Krishna, because Krishna is the self of myself. the two are inseparable. If I care about Krishna actually, then I care about me, because Krishna cares about me. If I care about me, I will care about you. It's that simple. And so, you know, Prabhupada completely cared about anyone who gave him their service and their faith, and continues to care, because he is still present with his faithful followers. So I'll finish there. Rahim says maybe somebody has a question. The question was, you heard that Prabhupada came into this street, but not into the building. Yeah. Well, he wouldn't have come into the building because it was a pub. He came into the street in the back of a car. And I'm not sure whether that was 76, I think, or 77. And it was one of those 2 years, Prabhupada, you know, I guess it was probably 77. His car was driven into Surrey Street. And the question was, at that time we already had the building, but the question to Prabhupada was, would you approve for us to move Krishna here? Because we didn't buy this building to be a temple. This building, which originally was a variety of functions, you know, down in the basement it was called a beer keller, a German pub, you know. The ground floor was a seedy pub called the Coronet, and up here was a restaurant with a floor show, and the floor above was a kitchen, and then above that was a house of ill repute. Would that be a nice way to put it? Are you good again?
Sorry,
you
can see
Maharani. Oh, yes. Do give her my love. Yeah, she needs all the help she can get right now.
We have to go now.
Yes.
Do you allow me to say something?
Oh, please. Yes.
Because he is highly talented in very many ways. He can write, he can sing, he can paint, and also when he was in very place. So this was completely ruined place. It was ruination, this place here. This house was completely ruined. It was terrible. It was so dirty. And he, from this terrible place, make such a wonderful temple that is completely unbelievable. How he is talented, how Krishna gave him intelligence, because he is an architect, but he is the supreme architect, the best architect on this planet, because he built such a wonderful temple, and I can pay my debts to him, and then thank you very much. And Rohini Nandana is also my dearest brother, because this time he was here, I was a Sankirtan devotee distributing books, and it was very difficult, and he was extremely merciful to our party, and always he prepared wonderful breakfast that we have a strength to go out and preach and distribute books. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Columbia, inspiration. your dedication. They don't see Maharani. You know, she's not well. She has cancer. She's not good. The prognosis is not good. She's in hospital in Hastings, so they're going to see her. Oh, that's right. Prabhupada didn't come in. Yeah. But he approved. We bought it to be a restaurant, and the temple was going to be a much bigger place. You know, we were looking at Kensington Town Hall, which was since demolished. We were looking at a large school in Regent's Park. In the end, we spent our money on Chaitanya College instead. That's how I call it. And so suddenly, you know, we had to move Krishna from the old place. And the question to Prabhupada was, can we move Krishna here? And so that's how Krishna came here.
He approved.
Hmm?
He approved of that.
Oh, yeah.
Was that the occasion when you were describing earlier? You were describing.
Oh, the last time? I can't remember, but I think it might have been. I'm not sure. It's in my book, actually. I did research it. So I think it might be, yeah. I'm staying for a while, but if anyone does want to get a book, I think they're available somewhere. I will sign them.
I saw a poster in the tube. I think it was Top of the Court Road. It was some dingy tube, you know, it was a modern moment. And it was Krishna Balaram. It was one of those, I think they printed the name on the Dhamma ones, you know. And it's one where Krishna is leaning on Balaram. Two cows and the spiritual world. And, you know, and it just took me away. I mean, I just saw this poster. It's so beautiful. Right in the middle of this, you know, place. And there's so many ways. London was just sort of full of the devotees. Everywhere, everywhere I went, I seemed to bump into them. High Street, Kensington, just walking along my neighborhood. Hey, man! Huh? You know, you don't have to smoke dope to get high. Oh, yeah, sounds good. Kept meeting people going to different places. And then one time I was Haverstock Hill, and I saw these devotees carrying this huge seat. I mean, it was colossal. I think it was at Edinburgh, it was just going down the street, this great throne, you know. So I just went along, followed on, and it was a bell-sized hall. A program go along. I went in there with a friend. At that time, I was a social worker working in the Simon community, and we went in. We sat near the back, and me and my friend, you know, and Prabhupada started to talk. I also couldn't understand what he was saying. I was interested, definitely, and I just like it, just struck, you know. And then after a while, my friend got bored, and he leaned forward in the seat and he struck up a cigarette. And it seemed to me immediately he'd done that, Prabhupada said, put that out! really loud, you know, I understood that. And everyone turned and looked at us. Of course, my friend put the cigarette out. Prabhupada resumed his talk. And then a few minutes later, you know, my friend said, come on, Rob, let's get out of here. Let's go. And I didn't go. I said, no, sorry, I'll stay. So I did stay. And I was, you know, just amazed by Prabhupada's presence, his beauty, his power. And he's just like guilelessness, you know, like at the end, you know, bring on the Krishna books. He had somebody hold these books up and start canvassing to become a life member. You know, it's like 108 pounds, 150 pounds to become a life member. I couldn't believe it, you know, and that climate, you know, in the 60s, it's like, you know, to talk about money so openly was just amazing. You know? So then I used to visit the temple on my days off and eat prasad. And then one night, and we had a place in Malden Road, which is Kentish town. It was a derelict area, and there were many houses that little kids were setting fire to, and you know, people slept in, and rubble, and you know, it was like that. And so Simon came in a little night shelter, and so one night, these four kind of like beings were coming up the road. Through the rubble, the dereliction, that's the right word. But they were like floating along. And who are they? Well, they were Hare Krishnas, and they missed the last tube back to the temple. So they'd heard that we were a night shelter. And I, oh my God, you know, they were so clean, you know. So I said, all right, well, yeah, okay, fine, we'll arrange something. So we made a little space for them, and they didn't want any bedding. They had their chuddas. Lay on the floor with each other. And it was just so beautiful to look at, so clean, and just such a difference, you know, in the atmosphere there. So I said to the night watchman, you know, just get me up early, I want to speak to these people, you know. So get me up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, I wanted to see them. So he woke me up, and I said, oh, they still know, they left. They just got up at 3:30 in the morning and walked off. You know, gone to very places to get there for Mongol art. I was just amazed, you know. And, I was looking for the Bhagavad Gita, and there was a bookshop in Charing Cross Road, and they didn't have a copy. So then they told me, maybe get one in the temple, Berry Place. So I went there, and this tall American called Dayananda was the president, and he just got a big shipment of the two volume sets, Krishna books, silver ones, you know. And they filled up the shoe room totally. And so I said, I hear you've got Bhagavad Gita for sale. He said, well, yeah, but the thing is, probably there's a book you need to read before you read the Bhagavad Gita. This is transcendental trickery going on here. So I said, oh yeah, okay, I'll take that. So then I ended up walking out with two volumes of the Krishna book, you know, big ones. So I took them back to to the place where I was staying in Kentish Town. Used to dip in there every day, read the stories of Krishna book. Just love them. You know, and you get to the end of the chapter, and it says that anyone who reads this chapter will, you know, get this, become a devotee. And you know, oh my God, this is a bit much. But it was so interesting, we're going to carry on to the next chapter. So it kept me going through the Krishna book. Anyway. I thought, this is so amazing, it just must be true. It just, you know. And then when I read the Bhagavad Gita, I couldn't find any flaws. You know, when you study something and you find that it's all the calculation is perfect, you have to accept the conclusion. And the conclusion is we're hearing, you know, just surrender, you know. Surrender. Krishna, I'm yours, you know. So then I used to visit Berry Place. Just all, you know, just like what she was saying, I just carrying on. So, what I thought to do today, I wrote on their 10th anniversary, right, Alana's 10th anniversary. So, I read it to you once, and I thought I'd read it again. because probably no one else heard that here. I don't know if you heard it. It's in this room, actually. And so it may be a little dated. I don't know, it probably is. But I'll just read it again. November the 25th, 1979. You appeared at the request of your pure devotee. Unknown was your strength, unknown your beauty. The streets of hellish London were shrouded in a mist, one time Prabhupada called London hellish, of ignorance and death, a struggle to exist. Walking shadows of who we should be, dark tomorrows were all we could see. You appeared at the request of your pure devotee. Unknown was your fame, unknown your beauty. You came on before him and hid in this jungle of numbers and streets of cheated and cheats. Deliver those most fallen before to hell they descend, cried our dear Prabhupada, your dear friend. Where to find you, what to do? My dear Lord Krishna, I'm calling for you. Please appear in this small house at Seven Berry Place. Show these poor inhabitants your merciful, smiling face. Crying for you, he did not desist. Out of hiding you came. You had no strength to resist. Just 41 years ago, on this very day, Prabhupada begged you to come here and stay. He worshipped you with so much yearning. Oh, so humbly did he pray. A dancing puppet in your hands, but from your feet, his love could never be allayed. You then became his puppet and danced in his embraces. He bathed you with his love and adorned your lotus faces, clothing you with his desire to reveal your majestic grace, garlanding you with his request, please sanctify this place. Please accept these waifs and strays, refugees of Kali Yuga. Please give them the intelligence to take nice care of you. He sailed away in many airships far around the earth, while here in London you reside to purify our sight, to take away the shackles of Maya's gripping curse, to enchant us by your beauty, relieve us of our plight. We've tried to follow his instructions, but sometimes we forget to be neat and clean and timely, which is much our deep regret. But you've helped us through the years, given hints to the pujari, how to be attentive to your care and give a little bhakti. What can we offer to you now? What is the value of our thing? Please teach us to remember you. Now let our love begin. Come summer's heat and winter's cold, let our minds not budge an inch. Let us make our Prabhupada's wishes life and soul, and from his order never flinch. Let us glorify you everywhere, bring everyone in town out of the stench of bars and clubs, from Soho's filthy streets, from the hawk-like glare of greedy men, from the evil frown. Let them all fall before you at your fragrant lotus feet. Let me go see that innocent young boy. Some time with him I'll spend. He came and prayed to you to care for us before he did depart. And now you must be happy. Your Prabhupada is here again. He always comes to see you. He's got you in his heart. Your devotees are here as well, so very mild and meek. They're begging for your mercy and falling at your feet. They want to crown you Lord of every heart and soul, of every deed the purpose, of every life the goal. They want to see your holy names proclaimed across the land. Every pub like this, a temple. Every song, your sankirtan. And folk will soon be queuing as far as Oxford Street, just to have your darshan and see your lotus feet. You appeared at the request of your pure devotee. Now known is your strength, now known is your glory, to some extent. The streets of hellish London are shining with much bliss, and knowledge of you and Amrit, which is everybody's wish. We can see ourselves and who we should be. A future bright is all we can see. You appeared at the request of your pure devotee. Now known is your fame, now known is your beauty. Sisi Radha, my name is Chuta Gotra. Prabhupada said we're all in the family Krishna. He said we also have our ISKCON in the spiritual world. So it's our wonderful philosophy again, Chinchipangaveda Tattva. I want my family back. Was it somebody saying that a few years ago? I want my family back. So that's exactly what it is. We've lost our family, and it's always a story when somebody loses their family and they want to find them again. Somebody was an orphan, or somebody was fostered or somewhere, and then later on in life they, you know, it's a touching story when you hear they meet their parents again, they meet their sister or brother, and they haven't seen them for the whole life. So it's like that. We are all in Radhananandeshwara's family, and we're so fortunate because, you know, we wherever we are in this world, you know, once we've been touched, once we've actually tasted Krishna consciousness in some form or other, we come in touch with the magic of it, or the poison of it, or whatever you want to call it. Then we'd be hooked. You know, we can't go anywhere without actually, you know, having that connection. And it serves us totally. And we see people that they don't know who they are, they don't know where they're going. And one time in Oxford Street, Prabhupada was driving the taxi, and he was looking out the window and he was crying. And his servant, I think it was Sri Dikali, said, I thought something was the matter with Prabhupada. He was upset about something. I said, well, what's wrong? He said, I'm just looking out the window, people are so unfortunate. And the devotee looked out the window and saw these people, bags of shopping, and it didn't look particularly unfortunate. And Prabhupada saw them and he was just crying, they looked so unfortunate. Because he had the vision to actually see what was going on. One time actually Prabhupada said, you know you're making some progress in Krishna consciousness when you feel you're walking on a different path to other people in this world. Our friends, our brothers, you know, they're very fond of saying, we've been saved, we actually really have been saved. You know, without making a big song and dance about it, future is so bright, and our present is so bright as well. I mean, sometimes, you know, in the course of your preaching, you may say, so, well, I don't believe, you know, the afterlife. So they don't, you want to go for that kind of argument. Then you can say, well, what about the present life? You know, surely this life that we have is so sweet. You know, it's chanting, it's dancing, the whole package of Krishna consciousness that we were freely given by Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers, you know. So, one time a devotee in France, I think she was hit by a car at Sankirtan in Paris, and she was badly injured, and she was in the ambulance rushing to the hospital. And then she said to the ambulance driver, or the ambulance attendant, said, I'm going to leave my body now, I'm going to die. He said, no, I'm going to die. And she started chanting. She just left her body right in front of him. And the man, with so many people in that kind of situation, he'd never seen anything like it. And she was what we would call an ordinary Sankirtan Mataji going out there, you know, doing a little bit. And yet she was just, you know, she had everything she needed to leave her body in the most, you know, just wonderful way.